It's Tuesday, October 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, violence in the Middle East brings unease to diplomats.
Close to 50 roads and bridges have been blocked off by landslides, flooding, debris, and trees.
The Philippines still dealing with a slow and massive storm. Also ahead, will a top Democrat run for president? And singer Justin Timberlake goes home. It's all on today's International Edition. Even as violence between Israelis and Palestinians deepened on Sunday, the top U.S. military officer, Marine General Joseph Dunford, was in Israel Sunday, resuming talks on deepening defense ties despite disagreements over the Iran nuclear agreement. Israel was Dunford's first foreign stop since assuming the post of Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman. That happened on October the 1st. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is expected to meet separately this week with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas on the latest violence, which has left at least 8 Israelis and more than 40 Palestinians dead in clashes over the past month. Regional analyst Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver told VOA's Victor Beatty the long-running conflict has been overtaken by other regional security issues.
On both sides, there was hope that someday they would eventually get a compromise that each side could live with. And I think the world has just pretty much forgotten this. But I think it's a failure of leadership. And it starts on the Palestinian side, of course, with Abu Mazen, who's almost 80 and wants to retire to his house in Amman, Jordan. And on the Israeli side, the feeling that they're isolated after losing out on the Iran deal. Neither side is really interested right now in compromising.
Secretary of State John Kerry is to meet both Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Abbas in separate meetings. What might those conversations entail, in your view?
I don't think John Kerry is going to get far. He went many, many times, as you remember, over the last few years, trying to negotiate between the two. But the irony is that doesn't work. If you really think about it, the only times that this has worked, whether it was the Rhodes Agreement in 1949 or it was the Oslo I and Oslo II agreements, when the two sides really want to do this and they go out and they do it by themselves. Oslo was remarkable because they went to Norway and they held secret agreements on what they were going to do. I think it's nice that John Kerry is going there, but I think he actually can accomplish very little. I mean, the real issue in the Middle East today, of course, is not the Arab-Israeli conflict anymore. The real issue has to do with ISIS, it has to do with al-Nusra, it has to do with al-Qaeda, it has to do with Iran, and so this has now been kind of shoved to the side. That's the reality, and with Russia going into Syria, that's just further accelerated the trend that this is kind of an irrelevant issue, something we don't need to worry about right now.
Well, the top U.S. general, the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Marine General Joseph Dunford, happens to be in Tel Aviv. Apparently, there are reports that Israel and the U.S. are bolstering their security ties and say those ties are back on track despite dispute over the Iran nuclear deal.
That's very good. It moves in a different direction. But I think it's important because Israel has been the biggest ally for the United States, certainly militarily. In the Middle East, there's almost $1 billion worth of American military equipment there for future conflicts. Bibi Netanyahu made up his mind that he definitely was going to try to improve what had become very poor relations between Israel and the United States. And I think the Americans did the same. But Netanyahu did something else that didn't get a lot of attention, which is he's also seriously improving his relations with Russia, which is the same thing that Saudi Arabia is doing and that Egypt is doing. In fact, they're going to go from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and elsewhere to a conference in Moscow later this year, and Netanyahu went off to Moscow to have a discussion with Putin. So I think that's something also we need to pay attention to, because it means, well, the Americans are busy with the semi-withdrawal and we're not going to get involved in any more fighting. The Russians are going in, well, maybe with not too much enthusiasm, but to show that they're a reliable ally, they're not going to withdraw from the conflicts in the Middle East.
The latest wave of violence was sparked by rumors that swept through the Palestinian areas that Israel was planning to take over an East Jerusalem holy site sacred to Muslims and Jews. Israel has repeatedly denied any such plans. Well, we turn now to what's being said online about our program's top story. International Edition's social media correspondent is G. Abby Lee. She's right here in Studio 22. Hi, G.
Hello, Jim.
Any word from the involved parties?
Yes, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in particular has been pretty active on Twitter, and his handle is @IsraeliPM. The account tweeted a video of Netanyahu meeting with General Dunford Monday. It's pinned tweet, which means that's the first one that shows up on its Twitter page, is also about the conflict between Israel and Palestine. The pinned tweet is a clip of Netanyahu at a press conference held inside the Israeli Foreign Ministry, and in the clip, he says they are false rumors of the Israeli government executing innocent Palestinians. The Israeli Foreign Ministry is also on Twitter @IsraelMFA.
What about General Dunford? Did he tweet about the visit?
Surprisingly, no. His last tweet is from Saturday, and it's about the Tennessee shooting. He is on Twitter, however, @GenDunford. That's GenDunford.
And what about from the Palestinian side?
There are no tweets from its UN missions account as of Monday. The official Twitter account of the Palestinian mission to the United Nations is @Palestine_UN.
It's a rather quiet day on Twitter regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict then, right?
It is. But I think the main reason is because it's been going on for a while, although the tensions are pretty high right now. But on a broader note, civilians in the region seem to be doing their part in trying to ease tension between different ethnic groups. The New York-based online publisher Vocative tweeted, "A hummus restaurant in Israel is offering diners 50% off if Jews and Arabs sit together." Back to you.
Interesting. A little bit of food diplomacy. Well, thank you for your insights, G. Abby Lee. And she tweets for our VOA International Edition Twitter account, which is @VOA_IE. You can also follow her on her very own individual account. It's @GAbbyLee. This is VOA.
#VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at #VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, @PerryCal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. Slow-moving Typhoon Kopu slammed into the northern Philippines on Sunday. It has killed at least two people and caused thousands to evacuate their homes. It's a story we continue to follow as we hear the latest from Manila, as Simone Orendine briefs International Edition host Susan Yaki.
Well, it is slow-moving. The forecast, State Bureau has said that it's just crawling along at 5 kilometers per hour, which means that it's just dumping lots of rain. It's got a cloud span of 600 kilometers, and so there's rain falling everywhere. And as it's moving towards the west, the State Bureau also says that it's expected to have rainfall that's equivalent to half a month within a 24-hour period. So they're expecting just some very serious flooding, and they're greatly concerned about this. So far, what it's left in its path has been inundated rice fields. There have been reports of farmers who've said they just lost 2 months' worth of crops. People on their rooftops trying to just get away from all of this water, which is all, it's muddy water coming down from the mountain. It hit a mountainous area first. It made landfall right by the Sierra Madre mountain chain on the East Coast. And because the mountain was up there and there was a high-pressure area to the west, combined with another typhoon behind it on the east, it just remained stationary there and was moving even slower than 5 kilometers at that point. This was on Sunday. And so it just kept dumping and dumping rains and caused landslides that have, at least in 4 locations that we know of, according to the Civil Defense Office, blocked off towns.
Tell us about in the cities, power lines down, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it knocked out power lines. At one point, something like close to 80 municipalities and cities were without power, but then some of it's been restored, and about 24 are still without power. Apparently, some communications lines were also knocked down in 2 places or maybe 3 in several towns. There's been a lot of debris that the military is trying to clean and clear up. Close to 50 roads and bridges have been blocked off by landslides, flooding, debris, and trees.
As the storm continues to hover over the Philippines, it could dump 60 centimeters of rain over the next several days. Here in the United States, politics could become even more interesting should the current vice president decide to make a bid for the White House in 2016. Joe Biden has not said one way or the other if he plans to run for his party's nomination, a race currently dominated by Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone is in our studio. Jim, Biden's presence has been somewhat of a distraction for the Democrats.
His shadow kind of looms over the race at the moment. Some would suggest maybe a little less after that debate, because Hillary Clinton did quite well. And to a lot of the experts, it seemed as though she sort of reclaimed a safe position as front runner, even though Bernie Sanders also continues to do well. Both Clinton and Sanders got a slight bump in the polls after this latest debate, but to some people's idea, it presented less of an opportunity for the vice president to get in. That being said, there's quite a bit of sort of rumblings and speculation early this week that the vice president is gearing up for a run, but even the White House said Monday it's still not clear when the vice president is going to announce whatever his decision is.
What is that doing to the Democratic race?
Well, it does kind of freeze things to a degree, and there's even been a back and forth now between the Clinton campaign and some of the Biden supporters have accused the Clinton campaign of trying to bully him into a decision because they don't want to wait around forever to find out what he's going to do. So the longer this goes on, there would be some tensions there potentially. And again, you know, who are the constituencies that Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden are trying to appeal to? Quite similar, really. There's not a lot of difference on policy there. And some people are wondering, Biden may be wanting to get in as a sort of fallback if Clinton continues to have problems down the road, if the Benghazi investigation heats up, the email controversy and so forth. But the other thing about Joe Biden we have to say is he has made 2 tries for the presidency. They were 20 years apart, but he's long wanted to be president, and it's clear that this would be his last opportunity to at least try. And you throw in the mix, of course, the tragedy involving his son, Beau, a wish by his dying son that he run one more time. So there's a lot there to sort out for Vice President Biden, but we've seen him on some of these talk shows when he's been asked, and he's clearly been conflicted about whether or not to go.
It's perhaps a good strategy for him, if he in fact is deciding to run, to kind of stay out of the fray for a while and perhaps just kind of jump in late and say, here I am.
He could. And of course, one of the things that makes that complicated later on, late in October, more into November, you have to start registering in various primary states your campaign. And it gets a little tougher if you're not officially on the books, so to speak. So in the old days, and I'm talking way back, decades, last century, people would wait. And it was the era of the dark horse candidates and going to a convention and trying to sort it out there. In the modern era where the primaries are held early, delegates are selected based on the results of those primaries and caucuses, it's much harder to wait and swoop in at the last minute. I'm sure he's heard from plenty of Democrats saying, if you are going to do it, we need a decision sooner rather than later. And I think his supporters and this whole draft Biden movement has been calculated to try to put a little gentle pressure on him to decide.
Our front runner for many years has been our senior political correspondent, Jim Malone. Jim, thanks for stopping by.
Always a pleasure.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
All right, we all know Justin Timberlake. He's been around for quite a while now already. The pop singer has garnered a lot of awards during his career so far, but perhaps one of the most surprising and special came just a few days ago. Justin Timberlake's music doesn't bring Memphis, Tennessee exactly to mind.
Said all I want from you is to see you tomorrow. And every tomorrow, maybe you let me borrow your heart.
But Memphis is his hometown. And on Saturday, he was inducted into the Memphis Music Hall of Fame.
I'm serious. This is the coolest thing that's ever happened to me. The Grammys are political. The Emmys are political. Memphis is not political. And don't get me started on Hollywood.
Timberlake's 20-minute speech served as a tribute to the city that is home to Beale Street, Stax Record, and is an epicenter of the blues and soul.
I felt like it was sort of unwarranted when I first looked at the list of my fellow inductees. But I've also never been one to turn down a reason to come home and spend time in the city that I grew up in and that holds such a special place in my heart. I also don't turn down free awards, so this all worked out.
Memphis is known for great R&B and soul artists like Sam and Dave. Otis Redding.
Sitting in the morning sun. I'll be sitting when the evening comes.
And Al Green.
It's all in the day.
Justin Timberlake performed covers of those artists' songs while at the city's Cannon Center for a crowd of about 2,000 who gathered for Saturday's event.
I've been all over the world 13 times. But London ain't got no Gus's fried chicken. You know what I'm saying? Paris may rendezvous, but they ain't got no rendezvous. Egypt has the pyramids. They don't have a Bass Pro Pyramid.
It won't be the last musical award for Timberlake, but likely will remain one of the most special for him. In Washington, I'm Jim Stevenson.
Don't act like it's a bad thing to fall in love with me. Zoom around and find your dreams come true with me. Spend all your time and your money just to find out that my love was free.
Been listening to International Edition. Our program can always be found on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, stay up to date on all the latest news and information from around the world. It's all in one convenient location. You can also follow us on Twitter, our handle at @VOA_IE. We're there every day too, and you can follow us via your mobile phone or computer, whatever kind of a device you have. We thank you for joining us. We also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zena Bobdell-Rockman. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has again called on China to release Christian human rights lawyer Zhang Kai, who was detained by authorities in August. Mr. Zhang had helped Christian churches fight the government's campaign in Zhejiang province to remove crosses and demolish churches. He was arrested just prior to a scheduled meeting with U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, David Saperstein. Secretary of State John Kerry raised the issue of Zhang Kai's detention at the release of the State Department's annual International Religious Freedom Report. At the same event, Ambassador Saperstein stated that despite widespread continuing government abuses and restriction on religious practice, he observed many places of worship that were full and flourishing during his August visit to China. He also observed that in certain areas where the government's hand was lighter, faith-based social service agencies were able to make positive contributions to their society. Nonetheless, Ambassador Saperstein cautioned that far more often, restrictive policies still stifled religious life. The State Department has listed China as a country of particular concern every year since 1999 for its severe violations of religious freedom. In its newly published report, the State Department cited allegations of torture, physical abuse, arrest, imprisonment, and harassment of a number of religious adherents of both registered and unregistered groups for activities related to their religious beliefs and practices. Examples include reports of the shooting and killing of Uyghur Muslims during house raids and protests after stricter government controls on religious expression and practice, the detention and torture of four lawyers in Heilongjiang province after they attempted to investigate an extrajudicial detention facility where Falun Gong practitioners were reported to be held, the sentencing of prominent state-sanctioned Christian pastor Zhang Shaojie to 12 years in prison, the detention of 50 Zen Buddhists after their businesses and homes were raided to examine residency registration documents, severe restrictions on Tibetan Buddhists, which led to the deaths of 11 Tibetan monks, nuns, and laypersons by self-immolation in protest. Secretary of State Kerry said, "No nation can fulfill its potential if its people are denied the right to practice, to hold, to modify, to openly profess their innermost beliefs." In addition to Zhang Kai, he urged the release of men and women detained or imprisoned anywhere in the world for the peaceful expression and practice of their religious beliefs, and called on all to affirm our faith in the principles of religious freedom that the world community has endorsed so many times.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.